This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Hi everyone, it's Ezra Zayed and you're tuned in to the Evening Edition. There are a lot of names out there. The moment it's mentioned, an image immediately pops into your mind. And when you see that image, it is intrinsically tied to something. It's immediately recognizable for what it represents and what it stands for. So in 2012, which is about 3 years ago now, it was the first time I had heard the name of a young girl named Malala Yousafzai. And back then, the image that came to my mind when Malala was mentioned, unfortunately, it wasn't a pretty picture.
Lying near death, 15-year-old who was shot for standing up to the Taliban.
Tonight, Malala remains in intensive care.
She was shot in the head by the Taliban for daring to suggest girls should go to school.
Now millions around the world are watching to see if she will die for her cause.
And as you heard earlier, a 15-year-old Malala and her friends were traveling home from school.
Muniba was here, and then I was sitting next to her. Here was I.
She and three of her friends were on the school bus at this time.
Then here was Shazia, and here was Skynath.
It was here when a Taliban gunman entered their school bus and asked for Malala by name.
The Talib came here and I was just very near to him. And then he asked, "Who is Malala?"
Malala was shot with a single bullet which went through her head, neck and shoulder. Two of her friends were also injured in the attack.
The next two bullets hit Shazia and Skynath. Two bullets hit Shazia. The bullet that hit her in her left shoulder hit Skynath. So one bullet hit two of them and one bullet went through the hand of Shazia.
Now, Malala just narrowly survives this horrible incident. But the most obvious question is why? Why was a 15-year-old shot in the head by the Taliban in Pakistan? What was it about her? Or what was it about her or what she represented that made her such a threat to them and their ideology? The story starts with her father, Ziauddin Yousafzai. He was known as an advocate for education in Pakistan. And the situation there is pretty grim. It has the second highest number of out-of-school children in the world. And as a school teacher himself, he became an outspoken opponent of Taliban efforts to restrict education and stop girls from going to school. Malala, his eldest and teenage daughter, joins him in campaigning for girls' right to education. And ever since then, the two have become global advocates for the millions of girls being denied a formal education because of, well, a variety of reasons, social, economic, legal, and political factors.
Because usually we talk about terrorism. But not only terrorism is the hurdle, there are many other things that are stopping girls to go to school. We can see that children are suffering from child labor. Because of poverty, they have to do child trafficking. They are victims of early forced marriages. They are victims of sexual violence. And as well as the cultural norms and traditions are stopping them. And her only job and her only life is just to cook, feed children, give birth to children, take care of her husband, her mother-in-law, her father-in-law. That's the life of a woman in Pakistan, in India. So that's why I wrote the book, to tell the story to people that this is what is happening in the developing countries. On one side of the world, we can see that the main issues about female is that what kind of clothes should they wear, it's about fashion, it's about designing. But on the other side, in the suffering countries, women are starving for education. People are homeless. Children are starving for food. They have thirst, and as well as they are starving for education. So that's why I want to tell the world that let's think about these people and let us think about these children and let us help them. This is not only the story of one girl. This is a story of every girl who has been suffering from terrorism in Pakistan and in Afghanistan.
Recently, my co-presenter, Umapagan Ambikepagan, he and I were at the movie screening of He Named Me Malala. You heard bits of it earlier, and it's the new documentary that chronicles the story of Malala thus far. And so right after the film, there was a discussion with a few other guests who were also invested and passionate on the issue of education.
Of course, you know, Ezra, my co-host on The Evening Edition, and joining us today is, on Ezra's left is Deborah Henry, co-founder of the Fuji School. On my right is Dathe Noor Azima Abdul Rahim. She's the chairperson of PAGE, the Parent Action Group for Education. You will be well familiar with her if you listen to BFM. She's on a lot. And on our far left is Alina Amir. She's a former Teach for Malaysia fellow, so, you know, someone who's also been on the ground and done the hard work.
And at this point, I should say there are no spoiler alerts, and it's okay if you haven't seen the film, but of course you really should. And as we began this discussion, we started to connect the dots between the challenges of education through the lens of Malala and the film, and how we as Malaysians reacted to a lot of the themes found in this documentary.
Being a teacher, being on the ground, I'm going to my third year of teaching, and every day after school, I'm like, oh, I want to quit. I don't want to do this anymore. But seeing this movie, I'm like, oh, I have no reason to quit at all. I have to persevere on. So it's a really good movie, getting me pumped up for 2016.
Just after we watched the documentary, we were having a little conversation earlier. And we were saying, is she special? Does Malala get all the attention? And you saw the comments in some people in Pakistan. Is she a hero? And da-da-da. But I think she said it best in the movie when she said, the reason I'm here is because my story is not unique. It is far too common. And I think she's speaking and fighting on behalf of the millions of boys and girls around the world who don't have access to an education. And I think that's very powerful. And let's be honest, she's a hero just because 9 out of 10 of us, probably given that opportunity, would probably have just shut up, run home, and not said anything or done anything. And she spoke up, she stood up, and she stepped out to make a difference. And that takes resilience. It takes strength of character. And she had something very intelligent to say. And I think just for that reason, she should be applauded.
Well, I'm here to represent parents, and I think that she is where she is because of the influence of her father on her. And I think that that's something we lack here, because I noticed that a lot of parents in the country rely on teachers for their children's education, and this should not be so, because even the Ministry of Education, in writing out the Education Act 1996, they say that pupils should be educated according to the wishes of the parents and not to the wishes of the teachers, because we believe that teachers and parents don't share their aspirations for the children. They have very differing aspirations, and until and unless the parents takes charge of the children's education, you will only get very mediocre education coming out of the system in Malaysia.
I think, of course, accessibility to education was one of the main themes of that film, especially for young girls. Were there any similar themes in watching the film about the challenges faced here in Malaysia?
I think we definitely has it better here. That's obvious. But in terms of quality education, equality, maybe we have space for improvements. So for example, when Malala was fighting for education equality for girls and boys, we see it here as well, but not as apparent, not so apparent. What we see maybe, what I'm working on right now is to getting more girls into STEM education, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. And there we see a big gap between interests when it comes to girls and boys.
Deborah, you've been running the Fiji School for some time, and you well know the problems about accessibility for refugees. Were there similarities in that respect?
Certainly. I mean, I think we talk in the movie, we saw us and other being girls versus boys. Boys have access and girls weren't allowed access. In Malaysia, perhaps the dynamic is slightly different, and it still has us and them, us and the other, us perhaps being Malaysians and others being non-Malaysian. So I work with refugee children, and so they're not Malaysian. They exist in a very grey area in Malaysia, and they do not have access to formal education. So it leaves all of us, the private sector, NGOs, to somehow make it work. And I think it's it's a struggle because, you know, it's, I think a lot of it starts in here. It's a mentality. It's how you view someone. And so if you don't view someone as an equal, if you don't respect them, then, and you don't respect their right to learn, their right to go to school, be it a boy or a girl, a Malaysian or a non-Malaysian, you know, you're not going to value giving them an education. And I think for us, as much as running the school and actually providing an education to the kids on the ground is important, it also is changing the attitude. I think Malala's dad said the biggest award is change. And it's changing the attitude of the public so that people see that a child is a child and all children have the right to go to school.
We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll be talking more about education issues in Malaysia, Malala Yousafzai, and the documentary He Named Me Malala, BFM 89.9. You're back with me, Ezra Zayed, on The Evening Edition, and we've been featuring some parts of the new documentary about Malala Yousafzai, the young teenager who was shot in the head by the Taliban for promoting and raising awareness about girls' education. It's called He Named Me Malala, and my co-presenter Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan and I were recently invited to a movie screening of the film. And one of the things you get from the film is a sense of what the environment was like in Swat Valley in Pakistan, where Malala grew up. And there's a scene in the film where the Taliban would regularly have these radio broadcasts, and they would use it to spread their ideology to their people. And their strategy was to speak directly and specifically to women about their issues, influence their thoughts and actions.
You see, our women are illiterate, ignorant from all other kind of information. When all other windows are closed, and the only one window that is open to their mind, that is Fazlullah's window, ultimately that man will have an effect on them.
The Taliban started the campaign that girls' education is against Islam and girls should not go to school.
The fardi ihtimam ki nabiya dini ilam manade aw da qabala ilam zanan da par hizr nishti.
Education was a threat to them. Education gives you the power to question things, the power to challenge things, to be independent.
The issue of opportunity and accessibility is of great significance, especially for children, girls, women, and other marginalized groups. And while we've seen more optimistic figures when it comes to girls' enrollment in schools and universities in Malaysia, there's still a lot of room for improvement, especially when it comes to the involvement or the engagement by parents in their child's education. In the film, we see Malala bringing change to the state of children's education through the changing of mindsets. And so, after the movie screening, Uma and I asked our guests, that's Deborah Henry, co-founder of the Fuji School. We have Datin Noor Azim Abdurrahim, she's a chairperson of PAGE, Parent Action Group for Education, as well as Alina Amir, she's a former Teach for Malaysia fellow. And so we asked them about what they thought about these issues, and here's what Alina had to say.
I think mindset change has to happen across every single section. And when it comes to parents, community, schools, administration, policymakers, and we're talking about graduates who doesn't have that high of a quality, that we need to change from the grassroots. We have to go back to primary school and how we're teaching our kids. What are we teaching our kids? That's the only way for us to move forward, changing mindsets across all sections.
Changing mindsets will also involve, I think, a more active role on the part of the citizenry, right? I mean, that's what we see from the Malala movie and her movement as well, is that they're not relying on governments, they're not relying on authorities. And in your opinions, do you think that the Malaysian public is too passive about this sort of thing? Because you guys work...
I do think Malaysian public can be quite passive, but also it's a matter of you don't know what you don't know, in a way. With the internet, with technology, we have access to so much information. We can teach ourselves almost anything today, but still we don't know what we don't know. So it is, and I certainly believe, you know, it comes down to the parents and all the stakeholders to play a bigger role and get engaged. You cannot sit back and go... We like to blame others and complain, right? So it's, oh, they're not doing their job, so-and-so is not doing their job, but it's being engaged, getting involved. And And that's when change starts happening, all the different players. And if I talk about, say, the Fuji School, we are dealing with a different culture. Most of our students come from Somalia and Yemen. So that's very interesting, because you have the parents who are slightly disengaged with their children, disconnected. They send their kids to school, but they're not really... If their daughter, 16, wants to drop out, she's going to be allowed to drop out. So they're not engaged. They're not committed to the importance of a girl going to school, to the value that that's going to bring. They can't see it. They can't visualize the importance. And when you can't see something, you're not going to work towards it. So that's a huge challenge for us.
Yeah, Nazima, talk to me about working with parents, because... Well, that's what your organization does. You engage with parents and you get parents to make the move, if you will. And is there an urban-rural divide in parents and their level of engagement as well, or is it a class divide?
Well, I think recently a survey was done, and we found that of the 40%, bottom 40%, I think 67% of them left the education of the children to the teachers, which is disheartening. But at the same time, I think at PH we are largely urban based, and we even you know, being urban based, you still don't get parents coming up to say this and that. They are actually quite passive, even among the parents, urban parents, and what more with rural parents. We have no idea what is happening with the rural parents. Again, you know, they leave it all to the school, and this is not going to get us very far.
And that 60-70% statistic, was that across the board as well? That was both urban and rural?
Yeah, it was. Yep.
One of my most favorite parts of the film was, you know, when Malala is in these schools and she's in Kenya, and you know, she asks all these kids, you know, what do you want to be? Do you want to be a lawyer? Do you want to be a dentist? Yet at the same time, when we speak to a lot of parents locally on radio, on one of our programs, there seems to be this narrative where kids are sometimes disinterested in schools, they're disinterested with their teachers, with what they're learning. For the both of you, you guys are engaging with these kids on a day-to-day basis. Is that passion still there? Does it sort of peter out? What are they excited about? What are they frustrated about?
I can speak on behalf of the school that I'm teaching at right now. So this school is... So we have about like 2,300 schools, secondary schools. My school is probably like in the bottom 100 school. And when you go in and you're asking them what their ambitions are, they're probably going to say something like police, custom. These are the things you would say like 20 years ago, right? And interestingly, my girls and I, we just started this club called GEMS, Girls in Engineering, Mathematics and Science. So what I did before we actually started GEMS was that I asked my girls, why don't you go around and ask all your girlfriends what they want to be when they grow up. So they went out and surveyed 186 girls from my school, and 60% of them has never heard of coding or programming, so they don't know what is in for coding and programming. 0% wanted to be an engineer. The closest to STEM-related career was a doctor. Everyone else wanted to be something they've already seen, a teacher, nurses, and suyuruma, something like that. You know, they're not moved or they're not exposed to other opportunities.
Deborah, is there a part for at least the kids who are refugees that their imagination goes beyond what they can actually perceive to experience or hope to experience?
Well, I did this not so interesting, I won't even call it an experiment, although it became one, with the kids when I first started the school. I did what my mother did with me. I gave them a piece of paper, coloring pencils, and said, draw. That was the entertainment before iPads. And I did that with them. I gave a whole bunch of students. They were about, I think, 8 to about 12. And everyone sat there and didn't do a single thing. Like, they didn't put pen to paper. And I was saying, the flowers, the sun, your house, your family, all these very obvious things that one could draw. And they couldn't imagine. And then I realized, these kids, they're here, they're physically alive, but their imaginations, their minds are so closed up, they're dead mentally. And think about a life when you can't imagine, when you can't visualize things. How do you dream? How do you have visions? How do you think about the future? And there's this study that was done that we're talking about hope. The more hope you have, the further you can see. And you see this especially with a community like refugees, because they've gone through so much trauma that you live day to day literally. And so the more hope you have, the more you can dream, the more you can vision. And that's what we've seen with the students. It's grown from not wanting to be anything even to now a myriad of careers. Like, I love when I hear them would say, today I want to be a pilot, next week I want to be a doctor, next week I want to be a designer, because it shows their thinking. And I think they see more. I think with the more education they get and the more they learn and see, they're just more and more empowered to believe in themselves, that they can perhaps one day make it to something. And that's, I guess that's the inspiring part.
After this, we hear more about issues related to our educational policies and the challenges faced by refugee children. Keep it here on the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. You're back with me, Ezra Zayed, on the Evening Edition. If you've been following us so far, we're talking about the new documentary featuring Malala Yousafzai, the young teenager who was shot in the head for promoting and raising awareness about girls' education. It's called He Named Me Malala, and my co-presenter, Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan, he and I were recently invited to a movie screening of the film.
Private schools in Pakistan are banning a book written by Malala Yousafzai.
The school board president said Malala represented the views of the West.
I think there are still many other people who are doing much more for the Pakistani community.
That's a big question for us, like why she's getting so much attention.
She's getting a lot of fame, and I think it's more of a publicity stunt.
Malala is the just name of a character. It can be anyone. She's a girl, she don't know anything.
Now, despite having won the Nobel Peace Prize and getting amazing levels of support from people all around the world, Malala's work seems to fall on deaf ears in her own country, Pakistan. Her book, I Am Malala, of which this film is based on, was banned. In the film, as you just heard, were a variety of reactions as to who and what Malala represents, even to her own people in Pakistan. And for those who disapprove of her, they express their dislike towards her and accuse her of being a tool of the West, and how her fame and achievement isn't truly reflective of anything of her own doing. But despite all of the negativity, Malala has persevered and continued to fight for girls all around the world.
Malala Yousafzai has joined the campaign to find Nigeria's missing schoolgirls.
Much needed help arriving with 17-year-old Malala Yousafzai, now in Nigeria, bringing with her worldwide attention.
President Jonathan clearly hadn't expected that Malala would be so tough and focused.
I asked the president that, what promises do you make?
I met him today and I told him, you are the elected president. You need to fulfill your responsibilities. And your responsibility is to listen to your people.
It is so hard to get things done in this world. We try, and too often it doesn't work. But you have to continue. And you never give up.
After the film screening, Uma and I continued our conversation with our guest, Dr. Noor Azima Abdulrahim. She's the chairperson for Parent Action Group for Education, also known as PAGE, and Alina Amir, a teacher and former Teach for Malaysia fellow, about their thoughts on the infamous educational policy flip-flops that Putrajaya is known for. And this was our conversation.
Dr. Azima, are you hopeful and optimistic that policies don't continue to flip-flop and change? Or is that just one of the few battles that Malala was talking about, that change comes in small increments and it sometimes doesn't work?
Occasionally, Ezra likes to crack a joke like that.
Well, if you think that science and maths and English, the flip-flop is actually really dying. It's going to die in 20 at the end of, primary school. For primary school, it's going to die, whatever. So if you say that the DLP is the reincarnation of PPS mind, isn't, because it isn't.
And it's not just a case of semantics of policy rather than program and those issues related to.
I think whatever is science and medicine English was a mistake to be abolished, and now they realize it and they are finding ways to disguise it to bring it back. But again, it's not a compulsory policy; it's actually a program, so you have a choice of having it or otherwise. I think, of course, those who were against it before see it as a flip-flop, but we see it as progressive change.
And the people you've spoken to about this program, if you will, are they amenable to adopting it? I mean, are the vast majority of them just indifferent, or given all the news we've been reading over the last 2 weeks about doctors, thousands of doctors quitting and all of that, I mean, surely there must be a move towards saying, oh, actually, this is something necessary.
Yeah, I think it is necessary. I mean, the article on the doctors, it's so necessary, right? That you have to learn your medicine in English. It's so necessary. And not only that, I think what has been mentioned also is that the blueprint speaks about that we are short of 236,000 scientists by 2020. And with, I think, one way of cutting short that process is to quickly engage our students in English so that the learning rate will be much faster.
No. Alina, just talk to us a little bit more about, I guess, some of your experiences, in teaching. Do you find that there's enough progress happening that you are hopeful and optimistic towards some of the bigger changes that will take place in the future?
Honestly, I feel there isn't enough people on the ground to truly understand what the education system is like. There isn't enough teachers on the ground to really understand, to have a proper debate on trying to improve our education system. There isn't enough teachers who are speaking up. There isn't enough students who are speaking up. We're only hearing a lot of people debating on the state or national level, but none of them have spent enough time with our kids or spent enough time in schools.
So there is a disconnect between policy and what's happening on the ground.
Definitely.
So what would we hear on the ground if we heard from more students and more teachers? What is your sense of the pulse on the ground?
I think we often speak about the rural and urban divide. That we know it exists. But once you go into the rural area, or you don't even have to go that rural, you can go to my school. It's in a small city. Most of the kids up to even from 5 are struggling with reading and writing. So what have they been doing all of their lives in primary school up to SPM? You go into schools and people are kids are sleeping, kids are not interested to learn. And when we ask them, why don't you want to learn? They ask us back, why do I need to learn? There is no relevance in the way we teach. They don't see a need for learning. They don't see a need for math and science. So if policymakers really want to make learning meaningful, then they need to come up with a curriculum that is meaningful for us, that is meaningful for the kids. And we need to move forward. We need to be more radical and braver in trying to fix our education system. And I just say, hey, why don't we improve teacher training? How exactly do you improve teacher training? Why don't we change assessments? But then if you change assessments, that means you have to change teaching. You have to change the way we teach our kids.
We also heard from Deborah Henry, co-founder of the Fuji School, about the challenges refugee children face when it comes to getting access to education. And this is what she had to say.
Well, just to comment on what was said, the good thing about refugee schools is that we exist off the grid, so we can do anything we want. what we've done is, because our students have had huge gaps in their learning, we're playing catch up, and it's just difficult to do it, especially when you don't have the right kind of teachers and the right kind of resources and things like that. So what we've been working on is, and it's not perfect, but we're working on basically, we call it the 21st century skills. And we're going, knowledge is good, math, science, English is necessary, but we need to prepare our kids for the real world, how to function. And so it's creating an entrepreneurial spirit, the ability to see situations, to analyze, to problem solve, project-based learning. It's to develop a lot of these critical skills that enable you to then take advantage of a platform, take advantage of a situation, apply yourself. Because we know that, like I said earlier, knowledge is there, it's out there. If we can teach children to teach themselves, teach youth to use what's around them, technology, to teach themselves, then they can continue doing that, while then being empowered with those strong skills, a strong sense of self-worth, to be able to then make it work in Malaysia, make it work in another country. And so we are developing these right now, coming up with perhaps some, maybe an app, maybe some online learning resources, slightly more targeted at the global refugee community, because it is the worst that it's ever been since World War II. And seeing if these are short kind of courses can will sort of resonate with the global community at large.
We've been speaking about access to education, empowering young students, and the themes found in the film He Named Me Malala. We've got more coming up right after this. Is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. It's the Evening Edition. I'm Ezra Zayed, and you've been listening to our program about Pakistani teenager Malala Yousafzai and how she emerged as a leading advocate for children's rights right after the Taliban had tried to kill her for speaking out on behalf of girls' education. The film, He Named Me Malala, it's a first-person account of her actions and personal struggles, from her ascent to promise in Pakistan to becoming the youngest recipient of the Nobel Peace Prize. Despite her young age, Malala is celebrated for her courage in voicing out about critical issues at the global political stage. An example was when she confronted US President Obama about the usage of drones in warfare at the White House back in 2013.
One thing that I love about you, you're meeting all these world leaders and you're not shy and you say exactly what you think they should be doing. You met with President Obama and you told him he should stop flying drones. You just said that to him.
Well, him and as well as to the Congress members I met in my last trip in June. And it's very important that you deliver your message to the right people. And if you say it's...
so y'all go to him next time, okay?
So if I, like, if I feel shy and if I think he would mind it, then these issues would never get highlighted.
That was Malala in a recent interview with Ellen DeGeneres talking about the importance of speaking out on critical issues to be heard by the right people. That's been our program for tonight. If you missed out on anything, download the podcast at our website, bfm.my. It's the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9. The Business Station.